This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei blames the United States and Israel for masterminding the recent riots in the country. North Korea's latest ballistic missile launch draws warnings of a tough response from South Japan and the United States. Plus, the upper house of Russia's parliament approves laws on integration of four eastern Ukrainian regions into the Russian Federation. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the recent riots in the country were plotted by the United States, Israel, and their paid agents. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comments in an address to military cadets in Tehran. The leader said that he was saddened by the death of a young woman, which triggered the riots, but he said reactions to the incident, including insecurity on the streets and burning of the Holy Quran and mosques, was not normal. Ayatollah Khamenei said the death of the young woman was a pretext for some foreign governments to foment insecurity and rioting. The leader added that such governments cannot tolerate Iran's progress and power. Ayatollah Khamenei described those governments as bullies, saying that they are taking aim at Iran's independence, resistance, and power. UK-based political analyst Masoud Shajadeh says the tragic death of Mahsa Amini has been used as a pretext by Iran's adversaries to instigate rioting in Iran.
It is a very sad affair of loss of the life of a young woman. But this is not the issue. This has been an excuse for rioting, killing people, burning security officers, and burning buildings, etc., etc. And, you know, it's very clear for a very long time, opponents of Iran, the regime in occupied Palestine, United States and Saudis and have been saying very clearly that they are set to create disharmony. They're there to actually create havoc within Iran and create this type of thing. And even when we hear the maximum pressure is a catalyst for creating the environment when this sort of thing could take place. This is really trying to create a sort of havoc that was indeed implemented in Libya, in Syria, and elsewhere. This is actually trying to destroy the whole infrastructure and bring such insecurity, which will affect every Iranian, be it their supporter or opponent of any issue whatsoever.
Iran's president says people's million-strong turnout and the protests against the recent riots foiled the enemy's plots during the unrest. Ebrahim Raisi echoed the Monday remarks by a leader of the Islamic Revolution, saying that the U.S. and Israel hatched a plot to hinder Iran's advancements. The president added that the enemy is angered by the progress Iran has made, despite the threats and sanctions. The riots erupted over the death of a young woman in a police station in late September. Days later, Iranians nationwide rallied to condemn the streets' violence. Muslims in London have rallied to denounce the recent Islamophobic violence by the British in the British capital, that is, amid Ongoing anti-Iran riots following the death of Mahsa Amini, several Western anti-Iran groups have staged anti-Iran demonstrations in European cities in which Muslims and police were attacked. Robert Carter reports.
Muslims in London were compelled to mobilize outside an Islamic center on Saturday following recent Islamophobic violence by anti-Iran protesters. On Sunday, the 25th of September, London witnessed an outpouring of anti-Muslim attacks as protesters claiming to support Mahsa Amini were filmed attacking Shia Muslims commemorating Arba'in and the Iranian Islamic Center of England, following clashes with police outside Iran's embassy.
Last week, our mosque was attacked. Our procession was attacked. People were attacked that weren't even Iranian, had nothing, they didn't know anything about what was going on. And it impedes our freedom of religion in this country.
Protests over the death of Amini, a 22-year-old Iranian woman who fell to the floor at a police station on September the 16th, started shortly after her death was announced. Those protests soon turned into violent riots, with masked people attacking security officers, resorting to vandalism and desecrating religious sanctities, including hijab burnings. Dissident groups outside of Iran were quick to board the bandwagon, engaging in violent protests throughout Europe, especially in London and Paris. A police presence remains outside the Islamic Center, with locals informing that groups are continuing to target the site.
Saturday's demonstration passed by peacefully without any major incidents occurring. However, locals informed me that they remained deeply concerned that future attacks may take place. They also informed me that they were deeply frustrated that the local authorities who failed to protect the community. Robert Carter, London.
Iran has once again rejected Ukraine's claims that it has provided Russia with combat drones for the war in Ukraine. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani called the allegations baseless and invalid. He said the Islamic Republic's stance on the war in Ukraine is quite clear and has been officially announced before. Commenting on the recent referendums held in four Ukrainian regions, which paved the way for their incorporation into Russia, Kanani said Tehran, based on its principled policies, always insists on fully observing other countries' territorial integrity. He added that Iran believes that any provocative action which disturbs the path towards peace and stability should be avoided. The spokesman noted that over the past few months, Iran has stressed the need for the warring sides to resolve their problems throughout political means. Canada has imposed fresh sanctions on 34 Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. The sanctions list announced by the Canadian Foreign Ministry includes 25 people, as well as 9 entities, including the English news network Press TV. The move comes a week after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau pledged to impose sanctions on the Iranian government. It is not the first time Canada has come up with such measures against Iran, with which it does not have any diplomatic relations. Ottawa in the past had blacklisted around 200 Iranian entities and individuals. North Korea has test-fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile over Japan amid heightened tensions in the Korean Peninsula. The test triggered an emergency alert in northern Japan on Tuesday morning, where residents were told to take shelter. Tokyo says the missile covered the longest distance ever recorded for a North Korean launch. That was also the first time a North Korean projectile passed through Japan's airspace since 2017. The missile test has drawn an outpouring of reactions. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida has described it as barbaric. The country's defense minister says Tokyo will consider all options, including what he calls counterattack capabilities against Pyongyang. Seoul says that it has rebuked the North for and has also warned a decisive response.
North Korea's such reckless nuclear provocation will face resolute response from our military as well as our allies and the international community.
The U.S. also says National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan separately talked to his South Korean and Japanese counterparts about Pyongyang's move. Sullivan has reportedly consulted on, quote, robust joint and international responses to North Korea's launch. Tensions are running high in the Korean Peninsula last week. Pyongyang conducted short-range ballistic missiles on four occasions. It came after South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. held joint anti-submarines on Friday. North Korea considers such military maneuvers as a rehearsal for an invasion. Russia takes another step to finalize the integration of four Ukrainian regions into its territory. Now the upper house of Russia's parliament says yes to the move. The Federation Council voted unanimously to approve the accession of Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia to Russia. That is after the country's lower house, the State Duma, ratified the legislation on Monday. The laws will be later signed for President Vladimir Putin to put his seal of approval on the accessions. Putin, the formal incorporation of the four Ukrainian regions. Moscow held a referendum in these areas. It says locals voted overwhelmingly to join Russia. Ukraine and its Western allies have called the vote a sham. The European Union always condemns Israel when it comes to its violations in the occupied Palestinian territories, including the regime's illegal settlement activities or abuse of Palestinians. But in practice, the EU's support for Israel remains ironclad. The EU's disregard for human rights and democracy has become even more blatant in recent years, which shows how its words of condemnation do not represent its actual notion of human rights.
When it comes to the relationship between the EU and Israel, one thing is evident. The EU comes out defending Palestinians and condemns Israel for its different violations, from settlements to the killing of Palestinians. But words of condemnations are just that, words. For when it comes to doing anything about it, it does absolutely nothing. There is a broad consensus that the EU is not an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine, and that the very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels only condemns Israeli illegal acts. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, which offered no proof to justify the terror label for Palestinian groups, or to the all-frequent military onslaught on Gaza. The EU has done little to hold Israel accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. Another sign of Europe's somewhat covert support for Israel is a memorandum of understanding between the EU, Egypt, and Israel, where Cairo is set to export Israeli gas to Europe. All this has also shed light on the West's double standards regarding the Palestine-Israel conflict, and this has only been further clarified through the West's support of Ukraine in light of the Russian special military operation there. The world rallied behind Ukraine and left Palestinians frustrated, who witnessed being criminalized and were constantly being told that they don't have the right to resist, or even labeled as terrorists or anti-Semites just for asking for their rights. Despite the long list of horrific human rights violations in Palestine and other atrocities in the world, the West is yet to display a unified response to the Israeli aggressions. But what makes matters worse is the West claims it supports human rights, like for Palestinians, yet it continues to do nothing when it comes to the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights.
If the EU is truly supportive of Palestine, then as a bloc, it would have moved towards recognizing Palestine as a state. As of now, just 9 out of 27 EU members recognize Palestine. This shows how the bloc does not advocate for real change in its action against Israel. No matter the regime is committing atrocious acts against Palestinians, it seems that the EU does not want to go against Israel in order to preserve its own interests.
In 2021, Manu Pineda, the chair of the European Parliament delegation for relations with Palestine, stated that Israel has inflicted brutal violence against Palestinians in Al-Quds who were resisting their forced displacement, so settlers can take their place, adding that this is part of Israel's ongoing attempts to erase the Palestinian presence from the city. But what he said further shows how the EU is actually funding the Israeli violations against Palestinians. He said the EU cannot continue to have an association agreement with Israel and called on the bloc to move to terminate it. This showed that the EU money was being used to fund entities and illegal settlements and to subsidize Israel's arms industry. Yet, in action, none of those promises were kept. Palestinians have been, in essence, ripped off of their rights and been subject to ethnic cleansing, occupation, and oppression for over seven decades now. And the double standard and hypocrisy shown by the West, especially the EU, only demonstrates that fighting military aggression as well as fighting for rights and how its approach towards or labeled is solely dependent on the identity of the aggressor with no regard to the tragic consequences. So in short, the EU may condemn Israeli acts of violation, but it truly supports Israel. Gaza is under a blockade by Israel, which claims it is the only way to confront the Palestinian resistance who hold power in the area. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell explained that there is no solution to the West Asia conflict without a very strong commitment on part of the US. Many attempts were made in the past, but at the moment there appears to be no path forward. Such reactions, however, aren't new to Palestinians, as they have on multiple occasions seen the EU and even the UN condemning Israeli actions, including warnings over the mass displacement of Palestinians, but no actions to prevent it. The EU says it supports Palestinians, but continues to further strengthen its ties both politically and economically with Israel, and this only proves that it is not an honest or effective stakeholder in the struggle for Palestinian sovereignty and independence. Its actions have so far only allowed Israel to continue its acts of aggression with complete impunity.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing European security polarization and the new Cold War against Russia with Professor Heinz Gettner from the University of Vienna. But first, this brief analysis.
Decades of aggressive eastward expansion by US-led NATO towards the borders of the Russian Federation following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the aftershocks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have led to a dramatic security polarization in Europe, not seen since the height of the Cold War in the mid-20th century. The dreams of a borderless Europe from the Ural Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean seem very naive these days, as a hard border is being established between the Russian Federation and neighboring European countries, with a dramatic increase in the level of militarization on both sides, which, if history is to be guide, will not be dismantled very quickly once it's firmly established. Even the previously non-aligned countries of Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. It seems the old British plan of preventing a strategic alignment between Russia and Europe and particularly between Russia and Germany, is once again being implemented. However, this time this effort is being led by Britain's American cousins, who inherited the British Empire following World War II. It's precisely in the period of the so-called American unipolar moment in the late 1990s and early 21st century, where the world witnessed the aggressive expansion of NATO towards the western borders of Russia. The instrumentalization of Ukraine, the weaponization of Ukrainian nationalism against Russia and Russian speakers in Ukraine, and the threat of Ukrainian NATO membership was the final straw and repeatedly stated red line that pushed Russia to take preemptive military action against NATO expansion into Ukraine. The severe reactions and sanctions by the Western countries against Russia have led Russia to strategically reorient itself towards the east and southeast, towards China and Iran. This has been very beneficial for Eurasian integration and particularly for boosting Iran-Russia relations, and it represents a very significant historic and geostrategic shift. But the question remains whether it's in the national interests of European countries to have bad political and economic relations with Russia. Is it really in the interests of many European nations to sanction and vilify their most important energy and raw material supplier and one of their largest export markets? Despite historically high inflation, the threat of closure of major industries, and exponential rises in energy costs, brainwashed Atlanticist European elites continue to repeat the anti-Russian propaganda designed in US and NATO think tanks, contrary to what many of the citizens believe, which is neutrality and non-alignment based on the real, tangible interests of nations. Of course, the people of Europe have so far received their reply from their elites. As for example, when the young, inexperienced German foreign minister proudly announced that helping Ukraine is more important than what German voters want. It remains to be seen how she and her party will fare the next time German voters get to vote on what they want. Cracks are already appearing in the European facade as nations such as Hungary and Serbia are trying to take an independent position based on their national interests vis-a-vis Russia, as well as countries such as Austria, who are warning about the consequences of unilateral energy sanctions and trying to moderate the anti-Russian rhetoric. But in general, it seems that nearly all European elites have once again shown their geopolitical impotence and inability to form policies independent from US and NATO diktats. As we head into this year's cold winter in Europe, we will have to see how much the European people are willing to sacrifice from their high standards of living in the pursuit of this new Cold War against Russia, which has divided Europe and forced a major historic and geopolitical realignment in the world, and which, contrary to US and NATO propaganda, does not appear to be in Europe's long-term interests.
Professor Heinz Gärtner, Professor of Political Science, University of Vienna, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You're welcome.
Professor, you've commented a lot. When we heard that you're coming to Tehran, we asked you to come join us in person for this interview. You kindly replied to this request, so here we are. We want to talk, as you know, the program Insight is really a program where we try to look at things strategically. We try to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. And one of the major issues of the world today is what the events that are happening in Europe, particularly the events that have now occurred with the war in Ukraine. And it seems that there is a new security architecture, a new security structure, a new reality that has descended upon Europe, a reality which in many ways is very similar to the Cold War. You have this hard border again being drawn between Europe and Russia. You have countries that even during the Cold War, like Finland and Sweden, who weren't part of NATO, are joining NATO. There is a negative, there is a heavy atmosphere that exists in Europe now. Something that many people were hoping would never happen again after World War II and the European integration process that occurred over the last 50, 60, 70 years. So if you could please give us your insight into how do you see the current state of Europe as it relates to these issues that I mentioned, security and the effects that the Ukrainian war has had on Europe.
Thank you very much, Dr. Torabi, for the invitation. I'm glad to be here in Tehran and Press TV in person this time. And thank you for your question. It's, of course, very important to look at this new situation, security situation in Europe in a broader context. So it's not just the Russian aggression on Ukraine, because, it has a history and has a context. So what we are, where we are now is a new situation of polarization. Mm-hmm. We know this polarization, we have several types of polarization after the Second World War. Of course, we had, you mentioned this, the Cold War, and we had this bipolarity. I have to say, at that time, the neutral states were able to stay out of this polarization, because neutral states were not part of the Cold War, because they were the exemption, the anomaly. They wanted to, Cold War was about blocs, polarization. Neutral states said, okay, we don't want to be involved in this polarization. I say this because it might be important when I talk about the Ukraine a little.
Professor, just for our younger audience who might not know the Cold War, because for us maybe who lived at that time, it was very, but if we could mention those countries that were neutral during the Cold War. We had, of course, Austria, where you're from, and if you could please.
The Cold War, of course, we had two major military alliances. That's what was the important part. We had the Warsaw Pact, and we had NATO after 49. And some states traditionally were neutral, so like Switzerland, Sweden, Ireland, because of special relations with Great Britain. And then during the Cold War, Finland and Austria accepted the neutrality. So for them especially was it important not to be drawn in this, for Finland not to be drawn into the Warsaw Pact, and for Austria that they get rid of the occupying powers. Austria was occupied by four powers.
Exactly.
And because of the neutrality, the four powers would leave. Very different to Germany, very different to Germany. In Germany was permanently divided, and Austria became permanently neutral. So we have this polarization during the Cold War. After the Cold War, there was another type of polarity. We had this American unipolarity. So, this American political scientist, Charles Krauthammer, coined the term the unipolar moment. Mm-hmm. And this was a very difficult time, because if you have unipolarity, of course, you have a hegemon who wants to dominate the whole world. What did not happen, but it was an idea of this unipolarity, and it was not peaceful, because some political scientists would say we have this hegemonic peace. If we have a hegemonic power, there would be peace in the world, which wasn't. Now we know.
Of course, in West Asia, we know this better than anyone.
We have Iraq, we have the Balkan Wars, we have Afghanistan. But there's a new study out, actually, that was very interesting, American study, which found out that after 70, 75, we had about 400 U.S. intervention.
1975.
Yeah, 1775. But the major part of this intervention took place in the period of unipolarity. 25% of this intervention.
Exactly.
So
more
than during the Cold War. More than during.
Exactly.
So unipolarity, that was really a very.
Well, that would also seem logical if we look at realist theory, realist international relations theory, when there is no balancing of that one power. During the Cold War, one could theorize that there was the Soviet Union, so there was some barriers. When the Soviet Union collapsed, it was an open field. Whatever they wanted, they could do, and there was nobody resisting them. So
very good observation. So basically, the most famous realist at this time interpreted this data very the same way you did it right now, because he said the reason, there are different interpretations, of course, but For Mearsheimer, the reason for this interventionism was that there was no counterpart for the for the U.S. And they did it because they could, right?
That's exactly.
Basically, that his prediction. I don't know whether that's true. We have to discuss it. His prediction is if we are moving to a new bipolarity, which might be China, new counterpart, because Russia will be weak after the war and the sanctions. And
right.
So, but China, his prediction is that the interventions will be reduced, will go back again, because China would be the major counterpart to the U.S.
That's very
I don't know, we have to discuss this.
But well, and also, I might add, if we even look at the regional level, if we want to take it to the regional level, we see that the only country that was resisting these American interventions, actively resisting it, was Iran in West Asia. How successful it was, we would argue that it was successful in the sense that they were not able to do certain things in Iraq, do certain things. They did intervene, but they were not successful. Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. So just to complement what you were saying, that
just to
on a regional level, you could also see countries
definitely
that could.
You can see it on a regional level. That's it plays out the regional impacts play out when you have a global polarization as well. If you have this global polarization, what we are in now, so some speak, like Mearsheimer as well, they speak of a new multipolarity after the unipolarity. I think it's a little bit a euphemism, because if you look at American strategic and defense strategies, they always speak about a great power competition.
Yeah.
So what they mean is US, China, Russia, so they might, but so it was not really a multipolarity, it was a great power competition, and then there are other powers beneath. So that we have Brazil, India, and other regional powers. So here you have mainly an economic level multipolarity, that's true. But if you have this new bipolarity, we are also in a phase of alliance building. Two features now with the polarization. One is alliance building, one is ideology building. We have so good and bad ideologies, but alliance buildings, and we see this. The Americans are trying to some extent successful. We have, of course, a traditional NATO here. So in Europe, Warsaw Pact disappeared.
Exactly.
So no counterpart in Europe, really.
Exactly.
No? Of course, you have the successor organization of the Warsaw Pact Treaty, the CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty, where the former Soviet republics. It's not very effective, I have to say, but it's kind of, but it's not not compared to NATO, for example, also in terms of military expenditures. In Asia, we have new alliance building. We have the AUKUS, Australia, Great Britain, US.
Yes.
And then you have also the Quad, which India, Japan, US, Great Britain as well.
Even South Korea?
South Korea wanted to become they're not yet, no? They're not yet
but they would like to,
Somehow they're pondering about it. So that's definitely true. But it plays out, as you mentioned also, so you say West Asia, others would say Middle East.
Yes, no, we say West Asia.
Of course, and what I think is we do have this Abraham Accords here, and it's a new kind of, not only, but also it has a dimension of an anti-Iranian alliance. Of course, there are all.
That's the main dimension, I think.
it has, of course, this cultural, economic dimension about the Israeli and Arab relations.
But of course, just to, because we talked about this before the program, for us in Iran, it's very funny because we see that they sign treaties or accords with sheikhs and with tribal leaders of that have flags and our nations, which the British gave them when they left in 1971. But they don't really represent people. I mean, this is the important thing. If you look at the percentage of the Arabs in the world, if we're going to stick with the idea that this is an Arab-Israeli problem, you have very small populations being represented, but the point you're making is well taken. That there are these alliances being trying to build these alliances. Of course, you mentioned Quad. You know, India is in a mess itself right now. It doesn't know where it wants to go. It wants to have the relations because it is in the Shanghai organization. Mm. It wants to have good relations with its Asian neighbors. Mm. On the other hand, because of the colonial legacy, as you saw immediately when the when the war started, you immediately had Boris Johnson going to India and saying, please let us, you know, supply you with weapons. Don't buy any weapons from the Russians. So, yes, your point is well taken. These alliances are being formed, but they might not be as...
I come back to this more global level as well. But let me just stay for a moment at the West Asia.
Exactly.
Just to support your point.
Yes, yes.
If you have weaker neighbors and a strong hegemon, whatever you want to call it.
Natural hegemon.
And their rankings, if you have rankings, means you have states, a list of states which are geopolitically stronger and which
exactly.
you have a ranking. But if you, you can look it up in internet as well, so it's called Global Firepower.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
they have about 30 or even more, 35 geopolitical criteria.
Right.
So you talk about population. Population is one criteria.
Exactly.
But it's also resources, it's education.
Exactly.
It's land mass relations.
Access to sea, yes.
It's discipline of the military. It's not included is nuclear weapons. They're not included. Then Iran comes out as 14th globally, well before Israel and Saudi Arabia.
Of course.
So according to the realist balance of power theory, what do? You build an alliance against
the natural hegemon.
It's a natural thing.
According to realist theory, this should be happening.
According to realist, it should be happening. Of course, you can act against it as well. What Iran is trying to do with regional cooperation.
Exactly.
You can mitigate.
Exactly. Because the same people who are signing the accords, they're sending their ambassadors, their foreign ministers.
That's good.
Exactly.
That's happening at the same time.
Exactly.
So that you have this liberal theory as well, and you have the realist theory.
And it's interesting that Iran is pursuing the liberal theory, which some people might be surprised
that's
to.
That's a good observation.
We are the most liberal country we want to maintain the Sykes-Picot borders.
If they're successful, it would be fine.
Exactly.
So, yeah, because it is the previous government, but also the present government trying to.
Of course, we talk to everyone. We're open to talk to anyone except for Israel.
If it is successful, yes.
Yes.
But coming back to this global level as well, because I didn't finish, we have this alliance building.
Mm-hmm.
Russia is not very good in alliance. It has allies in the Middle East, in Latin America, but except the CSTO, the Collective Security Treaty, is not not very strong. China is interesting because they have this partnership program and the Belt and Road.
Right.
So the Chinese government would call it its multilateral.
Of course.
But of course, there is a network of bilateral agreements and treaties economically, but also politically.
But it seems to be more focused on this idea of economic growth and less of this idea of having Chinese bases. We don't really see Chinese bases in Djibouti. We have one. I don't know if there's another one.
That's true. But you have the Shanghai Cooperation, where Iran now is member, but it's not really a security alliance.
It has a security element.
It has an element, a security dimension. But also China doesn't really have security alliances like NATO. And the second thing would be ideology, and that's interesting. That's why the U.S. is, President Biden is trying to create this alliance of democracies. It's an ideology, like we had during the Cold War. We had the market economy.
It's almost the same language. The free world.
We have the market economy on the one hand, the democracies, the state economy and communism. So it's very similar. You're correct. And ideologies are always hypercritical, always. If you have an ideology, it was somehow hypercritical during the Cold War, and it is now.
Exactly.
Because the U.S. has very good relations with autocracies as well when it comes to geopolitical consideration.
Saudi Arabia comes to mind.
Saudi, and also the Europeans. They say, well, we are part of this alliance of democracies. But just Chancellor Scholz was now in Saudi Arabia and then the Emirates, exactly. And because of energy, which is more important.
Democracy, except for XYZ, whoever.
Geopolitics.
Exactly.
Dominates values.
Exactly. Exactly.
You can have values, but also if you look at Europe, President Biden comes to the NATO summit in Brussels.
Yeah.
He would say we are an alliance. NATO is an alliance of democracy. The next day, the European Union comes. No, Turkey, Hungary, Poland. No. You don't share our values.
Right? Exactly.
So you see. Okay, it's an attempt. You know, it's
So that's very interesting, Professor, because to go back to what we were talking about initially, which is Europe. So we see this during this unipolar moment, we see this massive expansion of NATO towards the east. Some would argue, because you said geopolitics trumps values, and there are certain things that are real national interests. So we have this massive expansion. We have also in the background here the timeline of NATO expansion for our viewers. We have this, in this unipolar moment, this massive expansion to Eastern Europe, all the way to the borders of Russia with the Baltic states. And it seems to me that maybe there was the only geopolitical interest that was served here during this expansion was the American geopolitical interest, going back to the old idea of the British Empire that Europe, that Germany and Europe should never be united with Russia in any way, shape, or form, because this would create a global rival. The idea of heartland, the idea of Eurasia being strong and being a rival to the Atlantic civilization, again, starting with the British, with Alfred Mackinder, and then later on, when the Americans become the inheritors of the British Empire after World War II, continuing this policy where you have Germany, Russia, and in the middle you have this band of buffer states who, whenever necessary for British and American interests, one day go against the Germans, the other day go against the Russians, whenever it's necessary. And of course, we see this issue for those who are interested in history, when you had the Hitler-Stalin Pact, where this idea of these Germany and Russia, and we're not talking about the Soviet Union as a communist state or Hitler as a fascist Nazi state, but the idea that Germany and Russia would somehow come to an agreement about geopolitically. Of course, immediately we see what happened then later with the Soviets and the entering the Allies against Germany. My point is simply this. We have this expansion, but it seems to me that it doesn't really serve the geopolitical interests of many of the European countries that are now part of the NATO. We have these newly liberated states from after communism with elites who maybe don't have this deeper understanding of what their long-term interest might be, being told by the West that this is so just to put away your history, to get rid of that Soviet legacy, that communist legacy, come join us. But we see now that if there's going to be a war between NATO and Russia, it is these countries that are going to suffer from it, which, of course, Ukraine being the main example. Because you talked about neutrality, and you've talked a lot about neutrality being a good option for many countries, Austria being an excellent example throughout history or modern history. If you could talk about, is it really in Europe's geopolitical interest that everybody is a NATO member all the way up to the border of Russia, or is there thinking among some people in Europe that would look at their real interests, Germany, other countries, that it might be in their interest to have peaceful, good relations with Russia?
Mm. Many good points. So I don't know whether we have the time to touch
on. No, we have the time. Sure, go ahead. We have the time.
But let's say for the NATO expansion.
Right.
Of course, I would say it was not a good idea, and many pundits warned. So it was also George Kennan who warned that at some point it will have consequences, and Russia will react. That was in the 90s when he already. Others would say, and also we heard voices from the Soviet Union. It was not just Putin, but others, and Gorbachev and Yeltsin, and they all. They would not agree to NATO expansion, but it happened because, of course, after the end of the Cold War, Russia was pretty weak economically and had nothing really to do against it. And of course, NATO expansion happened because it was possible.
There was no barrier.
And of course, the argument is, and that's only part of the argument, that all states, it's their own decision whether they want to join an alliance. We talked about alliances, whether they join an alliance or not. So nobody should object. Also, you can find it in the OSCE documents, the Organization on Security and Cooperation in Europe. You can find it. That's the one part. But the second part is it should not negatively affect the security of other states.
Exactly.
So if you remain in the language of realism, and
yes.
So we talk about the security dilemma. Security dilemma.
Yeah, exactly.
If you make a decision in your own country, it might affect the security of other states as well.
Exactly.
So that's.
Exactly.
And just think about the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it was a sovereign decision by Fidel Castro to deploy Soviet missiles here, but. Of course, the Americans are nervous. It's understandable that the Americans.
Exactly.
So now the Russians.
And of course, the Americans had deployed missiles in Turkey, which was right on the Soviet border.
We can have another lecture about
the Cuban missile
crisis. But that happened with Russia as well. But it was not only that one. I have to say, because Russia did not really have a good ideology anymore, because communism was somehow attractive to intellectuals.
Yeah, of course.
Now you have Russification, denazification, Peter the Great. They are not attractive very much.
Right.
But you have also coming from, so we you have coming NATO, you're talking about the heartland. We're talking about the heartland.
We have coming
NATO expansion from the West. But you also, which is not mentioned that much of Russia for standing reason, we have China coming from the east.
Yes.
We have the Belt and Road Initiative,
exactly.
Which has a soft power. It has some ideology. It's attractive to states. It's voluntary, so that's not states are not forced.
Exactly.
Of course, it creates economic dependencies later on and might be in difficulties for some. You have to be careful if you're
right. One might argue that this is a natural state of countries who are not viable, who need somebody to support them.
Economically.
If they have to choose between China, who doesn't say you have to accept a base from us, and you have to, they say, okay, we'll give you, we'll build your roads, we'll build whatever infrastructure.
It's
there is attraction to
and
it.
And also, it's coming to
support your point.
Eastern Europe, the Balkans,
exactly.
The former East European states, Bulgaria, Romania.
Exactly.
So, Russia is squeezed.
Yes.
And we were talking about the great power competition before.
Very good, yes.
And now, Russia, so the only reason I can stay in this great power competition, economically weak anyway, with nuclear weapons, is I intervene in Ukraine to prevent further NATO expansion.
Correct.
I think it was the wrong decision, and because now NATO is coming closer to Russia with the expansion by Finland
Correct.
And Sweden as well. So
right.
It is more danger for Russia than it was before.
Well, maybe they figured this is the last line that they can accept even Russia, Finland, but they can't accept
Ukraine. And then you mentioned that already in your first statement. What is happening now, we have this new Cold War in Europe. We have two new bipolarities, the global bipolarity between China and US.
Right.
And US would say, we concentrate now on China.
Right.
So you Europeans work hard that with Russia, and we have this bipolarity in Europe between
Correct.
Russia and Western Europe. So what is happening now with the former non-aligned states, Finland and Sweden, becoming NATO members. We have the war in Ukraine. We will have a new cordon sanitaire, not only Iron
right.
Curtain, from the Arctic to the Black Sea. And as I predicted, if you look at the war situation in Ukraine, as I predict, it will go straight through Ukraine as well. Well, it's mm-hmm. a deeper river, or it's at the Donbass somewhere, it will be an iron curtain.
Right.
And it will last very long, much longer than President Putin will be in power.
Right.
We know this. The old Cold War lasted decades.
Right.
So the Europeans will have to do something about this. If they don't want to lift this new cordon sanitaire, which was created by this great power competition, of course it was played out in Ukraine, One solution would have been neutrality. So that actually, I wrote well, I have to say this, well before Henry Kissinger, because I wrote a piece in order to avoid in Ukraine, the best option for Ukraine would be become neutral according to the Austrian model.
So that's active neutrality.
That means neutrality. I think that would have been a good idea.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on Arab English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Husseini Qumi. Stay tuned.
امام صادق سلام الله علیه پسری داشتند به نام اسماعیل.
امام صادق علیه السلام had a son by the name of اسماعیل. Once اسماعیل came to امام صادق علیه السلام and asked him for a consultation. اسماعیل wanted to share his money with a professional businessman who was an expert in business and transaction matters but was a drunkard man. امام صادق علیه السلام warned his son about accompanying such a man and told his son, "The drunkard is the most unwise, so do not accompany him."
حالا پسر امام بود دیگه معصوم که نبود که یواشکی رفت پولشو داد.
However, Ismail gave his share of income to the drunkard businessman and did not listen to his father. Ismail lost all of his money. When he was on the Hajj pilgrimage, he faced the house of Allah and said, "O Allah, I lost all my money. Please help me and give it back to me." Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, who was behind him, heard his request and stated, "What are you asking for? The person who is trapped because of his own actions is not either rewarded or admired by Allah. In other words, we are responsible for the results of our actions. If we are trapped by our own decisions, asking for Allah's help is a null deed." Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Color Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojatul Islam Hosseini Homi. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Color Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.